From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
There is no rational reason why a black male baby born today has a 1 in 4 chance of ending up in jail. That's a disgrace.
That was Democratic presidential hopeful Bernie Sanders speaking to supporters in Massachusetts Monday.
And together, we are going to bring justice to a broken criminal justice system.
He was speaking at a pre-Super Tuesday rally in Milton, Massachusetts.
You know, I was just thinking, not an original thought, but your state led the American Revolution. Now it is time for Massachusetts to lead the political revolution.
Polling of one kind or another will take place in 13 states Tuesday and American Samoa. Republicans and Democrats will hold primaries in Alabama, Arkansas, Georgia, Massachusetts, Oklahoma, Tennessee, Texas, Vermont, and Virginia. Republicans and Democrats will hold caucuses in Colorado and Minnesota. In addition, Republicans are holding caucuses in Alaska and Wyoming. Democrats are holding a caucus in American Samoa. Two reports of close encounters between drones and NATO air defenses. In the first, a Belgian drone crashed in northern France after that drone's operator reportedly lost control and the plane crossed the border. That, according to Belgian military air traffic controllers who notified the French authorities, the drone, which had a wingspan of about 10 feet, was briefly escorted by a French Air Force fighter jet before crashing in a field about 50 kilometers from Reims. No other damage was reported. Meanwhile, a correspondent based in Cyprus reported that 14 Turkish F-16 fighter jets were scrambled to shoot down an unarmed Syrian drone that was monitoring the shelling of Syrian territory by Turkey's military. Concerns about Turkey's military activities along its border with Syria have been growing, with Russia's Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Rybakov warning Monday that an armed intervention by Ankara would deal an irreparable blow to the Syrian ceasefire plan. He told reporters, quote, "Unfortunately, our Turkish colleagues still have not abandoned the idea of cross-border strikes," closed quote. And Saudi Arabia said that the U.S.-led anti-ISIS coalition discussed a potential ground troop deployment in Syria. In an interview with Reuters, an aide to Saudi Arabia's defense minister, Brigadier General Ahmed Asseri, confirmed that defense ministers from the anti-Islamic State coalition debated placing ground troops in Syria during a ministerial meeting in Brussels last month. The general said the discussions took place on the political level only, without going into details of a potential military mission, but he also acknowledged that Riyadh has been working on the military implementation of a possible Syria invasion. His statements were criticized by Damascus as being destructive and a threat to regional security. However, they were painted in a different light at the U.S. State Department Monday. Spokesperson John Kirby was asked if he was aware of the Brussels talks.
Earlier today, an aide to the Saudi defense minister said that 2 weeks ago in Brussels, the defense ministers discussed a potential Saudi incursion by the U.S.-led coalition. Are you aware of these talks?
I would refer you to my colleagues at the Pentagon for discussions that might have happened between defense ministers in Brussels. What I can tell you is what we've said before. The Saudis have talked about the potential of an introduction of some sort of ground force element in Syria to fight Daesh. And we said then, and we continue to believe, that sort of contribution against Daesh in Syria would be welcome. But there's a lot that needs to be discussed in terms of how, what they would do, who, what their makeup would be, how they would need to be supported by the coalition going forward. So there's a lot of homework that that needs to be done.
Would that be considered plan B? I mean,
no, you're mixing here. When we talk about the so-called Plan B, we're talking about alternatives to the political process, which is Plan A for getting a new government in Syria. what the Saudi suggestion was, proposal was some sort of ground force element to go after Daesh. That is a completely separate issue. There are 66 nations, which includes Saudi Arabia and now Afghanistan, that are contributing to the counter-Daesh coalition. There has been and there will remain, as we have long said, a military line of effort in that fight. And the Saudi proposal is in keeping with that effort against Daesh. It is not designed to contribute or to participate in or to lead to some sort of resolution to the civil war in Syria. The Saudis have been at the table with us as part of the ISSG from the very, very beginning. And they have been very helpful and a leader in this effort. And they hosted the Conference of the Opposition back in December in Riyadh. And so they are very and on the record in every communique saying that they're very supportive of a political solution to the civil war in Syria.
Nevertheless, as of early Tuesday, the ceasefire was largely holding due primarily to the will of the U.S. and Russia, as CCTV's Alaa Ebrahim reported from Damascus.
The past 4 days has been a demonstration of international will to make the ceasefire last. Violations that took place in the past 4 days could have easily ended the ceasefire, but the will of Russia and the United States of America have maintained the ceasefire. For example, on Saturday when rebels fired mortars on the Syrian capital Damascus, an officer in the Syrian military command told me that they received a plea from the Russian control room, which observes the ceasefire, asking them not to retaliate and to refrain from attacking positions where the mortars were fired from. A similar incident took place when a Nusra Front, the affiliate of Al-Qaeda, fired mortars and rockets from rebel-held areas in Latakia province to the north of the country, and the Russians did the same, and they asked the Syrian army to refrain from responding. So I think as long as there is an international will by the two major players, the superpowers, Russia and the United States, the ceasefire will hold on.
Last Thursday, Jamaicans cast their ballots in the country's 17th general election since 1944, voting out the governing People's National Party in favor of the Jamaica Labor Party, led to victory by 43-year-old Andrew Holness, who will be the next prime minister of the island nation. For more, we spoke with investigative journalist and radio host Lloyd D'Aguilar via Skype from Jamaica this past Saturday. Well, it looks like the JLP is in, the PNP is out, and are things going to change in Jamaica or what?
Well, listen, the International Monetary Fund looms large in the background. They literally governed us for 4 years, 4.5 years under the PNP. And they were there under the JLP before that as well. And one of the first visits that Andrew Holness, the new prime minister, is going to make is to the chief representative of the International Monetary Fund here in Jamaica. He's going to pay him a visit.
Meet the new boss, same as the old boss. Yeah, right.
So that gives you an idea as to what we are up against. Jamaica is one of the most highly indebted countries in the world. Our debt to GDP ratio is about 125%. It was 140, and the previous government brought it down to 120. But 120, by any way you measure it, is very, very high. We are as indebted as Greece is. So that unless a government is going to take a radical path to dealing with the debt, then the IMF is really the boss of the situation here. And the IMF is going to be the boss under this government as it was under the previous government. And that is where we need to begin in terms of responding to some of the facile electioneering slogans put forward by the Jamaica Labour Party about prosperity. What prosperity? What are they going to do about the debt? Until we do something about the debt, there can be no prosperity because we are going to be living under austerity. So the Jamaica Labour Party made promises, and I think they won because of the promises, because the previous government wasn't making any promises. They were trying to win the elections on the basis of their good stewardship and their good management of the economy, supposedly because they faithfully followed all the dictates of the IMF. They passed all the tests, so therefore they had set the economy right, and the economy was now poised for growth and development. So therefore, on that basis, the people should vote for them. But the reality is that passing IMF tests doesn't mean growth. And there are lots of poor people in Jamaica. As a matter of fact, the IMF said, I remember a report, 1.2 million people living below the poverty line. The population is about 2.7 million people. So if 1.2 million people are living below the poverty line, then, you know, this is very serious. I think I read the other day that 200,000 people were malnourished, weren't eating enough food for the day. I could go on and on. The infrastructure is crumbling. The situation in the hospitals is terrible. The schools, you know, are run down. Children are still using pit toilets. They don't have flush toilets in a lot of the rural areas. There were recent outbreaks of viruses in the hospitals, and newborn babies dying, that sort of thing. 13-14% unemployment rate, etc. I mean, the government had nothing to crow about, but yet still they wanted us to believe that because they were faithful to the IMF, people should vote for them because now it was time for growth and development. Well, the people didn't buy that. But what the Jamaica Labour Party did, their job was pretty simple, was just to say that you have been passing the test, but you haven't been passing the people's test. And so what they promised, and the centerpiece of their election campaign, was that they were going to raise triple the minimum wage. The minimum wage is about $500,000 Jamaican dollars. And they were going to raise it. Well, I'm sorry, it's not the minimum wage, the tax threshold. In other words, if you're earning 500,000 Jamaican dollars, you don't pay taxes. So what they were going to do is to raise it to $1.5 million. And so if you earn more than $1.5 million, then you would start paying taxes, but anything under $1.5 million would not attract taxes. No. That's a big, 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 big promise. And that went down pretty well with a lot of, you know, lower earning wage workers, because a lot of people are not making a million. They're not making right. $1.5 million. But if they do make $1 million, I mean, they're not taking home much money because the tax, you know, tax eats up all of your thing. So I think they won the election on the basis of that promise. That was a centerpiece of their program, which would have attracted working class people, which would have taken away votes from the PNP, which would have energized their base, and so on. And I think that was a centerpiece of their election campaign. Now, whether they can deliver on that is another matter, because once they came out with that promise to increase the tax threshold from 500,000 to 1.5 million, the immediate response of the PNP was that, hey, that is a pie in the sky. It's not going to happen. It's going to derail and crash the IMF program that we have worked so very hard over the last 4 years to maintain, et cetera, et cetera. So basically, you will be falling out with the IMF over that. So that was the response of the PNP, saying that the country cannot afford it, etc. And so there was an impasse over that. Well, the people didn't care about passing IMF tests. What they cared about was that, based on this promise, more money would be in their pockets. If you're going to be getting $20,000 more per month, or more per year, I mean, of course you're going to go for that. And so the JLP won hands down where that was concerned. It was still a close election. It was very, very close.
Yeah.
There are 63 seats in parliament. The Jamaica Labour Party won 33. and the PNP won 30. So it's very close. But I would say that this election, if not explicitly but implicitly, was a referendum on the International Monetary Fund. And I would say that the people have voted against austerity. They have voted against the International Monetary Fund. And now they have to put pressure on the new government to make sure that they honor their commitment to the people to increase the income tax threshold, because that is the centerpiece of their campaign.
Just for so Americans have some perspective, is the exchange rate is like 0.8 of a penny to the U.S. dollar? Is that right? It's like 0.00083.
Well, all I can say is that if you send me an American dollar right now, right, a U.S. dollar, mm-hmm, I will go, when I change it over, I will get 120 Jamaican dollars. Right. So you can do the math
there. That's about right. So when you're talking about 1.5 million Jamaican dollars, you're talking about 10,000 U.S. roughly.
Yeah, something like that.
Now, so how typical is that of the earnings of a Jamaican family?
Yeah, I mean, if you're making up to $1.5 million in your working class family, I mean, you're barely getting by. You know, you are barely getting by. I remember years ago, I had a job at one of the states, what do you call it now? Public broadcasting companies. And I was making under $1 million. After they take out taxes, I was taking home $40,000-$50,000. If I didn't have a partner, I mean, I would be in dire straits to survive. You just can't survive on that kind of money.
What's the economic condition there generally? Is tourism still the big money earner? I know a lot of the industry left, the mining and all of that. That was one of the legs the economy stood on. What's there now?
Well, it's been mining and tourism. That's really the two main legs of the economy. The tourism industry is still going. The People's National Party was trying to mesmerize us with all the statistics of what's been happening in tourism. They've been building more rooms, they've been getting more tourists, and they're promising to build, I don't remember how many rooms more in the next 10 years, and how many jobs that this is going to translate into. That was their campaigning. So tourism is always there, and I don't think that the tourism industry is going to collapse anytime soon. The problem, though, is that those jobs are low-paying jobs. I mean, throughout the length and breadth of the tourism industry, it's low-paying jobs that they create. So, you know, you're getting a job in a hotel to clean the place, to maybe serve breakfast in the morning, and so on. And, you know, those are, you know, a little bit above minimum wage. Those people are not making over $1.5 million a year. So so that's one aspect of the economy. The other aspect is mining, bauxite. And ever since the world economic crisis, bauxite has been in a nosedive.
Yeah, like all parties,
because we now have China on the scene, and China is scooping up the bauxite from Africa and elsewhere. There's an oversupply and a glut on the world market of bauxite companies. So several bauxite companies have closed down here. Aluminum companies have closed down. And so the mining industry is limping along. And I believe that has contributed to the high unemployment rate. Every now and again, we hear promises that, you know, this company or that company is going to take over a closed down bauxite company and is going to start production again. But it really hasn't happened. The latest promise is that the Chinese are going to come in and buy out, I think, a company called Alpart, and they're going to take it over and start mining again. Well, I don't know. We'll have to wait and see where that's concerned. So apart from tourism, there's really nothing else that's going on in the economy. Nothing else is booming. They were talking about a transshipment hub to take advantage of what's happening in Panama, where they're widening the canal and supposedly these huge ships, mega ships, are going to pass through the canal, and so we would take advantage of those huge ships coming in, where we would be a transshipment port to, you know, to store all the goods from these ships and then reroute them elsewhere. But nothing has happened where that is concerned. And I think that's all wishful thinking. So what can I say? We are a service economy. We buy goods and services and we sell them to our people. But in terms of production, agricultural production, converting our raw material into industrial goods in order to sell or to you know, lessen our dependence on imported goods, that is not happening and that is not driving the economy. There's no oil. There's, you know, and so the economy is limping along. And as I said, we have an unemployment rate of about 13% and 1.2 million people are living below the poverty line.
Before I get into the larger macroeconomic stuff, in terms of tourists, who are the tourists? Has there been a shift? Are there more, say, tourists from China than before? I know the U.S. Has been exporting fewer tourists since 2008 because people here are broke. You see any kind of a change in the, you know, in the nationalities of the people that are fueling the tourist industry?
Well, I would say that the U.S. continues to be the major market for tourists. It may have declined marginally, but the and there have been attempts to get visitors from Europe and China and Russia. Even South America, they have made attempts. And I believe that there have been some marginal increases where that's concerned. But substantially, the bulk of the tourists come from the United States.
And now that Cuba is establishing something approaching normalized relations with the U.S., it's going to become a tourist destination for Americans. At least some people here are banking on that. Do you think that that'll affect Jamaica at all?
Yeah, some people fear that Cuba might become a rival to Jamaica. The tourism experts seem to believe that, yes, you know, it may take one or two of our tourists away, American tourists away, but the industry will remain as is, substantially, you know, solid, and we will still have American tourists coming here and so on. But the effect will be marginal. I mean, that's the view that's coming out from the players. Whether that will remain is left to be seen. And I guess it also depends on what the economic state is in the U.S. and whether people have money to go on, you know, on vacations and enjoy the summer elsewhere or the winter, in a Caribbean tropical climate. So we'll see where that's concerned. But yes, Cuba will take away a few tourists, but I don't know if it will be substantially so.
And now, in terms of the larger picture, China also has been, of course, negotiating and reaching an agreement with Nicaragua to build a canal there. The Transcontinental Railroad they've been talking about in South America, deep water ports on both the Pacific side of Central America and in the Caribbean. Looking at a 600 million person market for their products, their finished products, and using a model where they try to invest in ways that increases the incomes, basically, of the market so they can buy the products. Do you see Jamaica? I understand the political contradictions that particularly have been manifest over the last year. The election of Macri, the election of the right in the National Assembly in Venezuela, the last weekend's referendum in Bolivia, for what that's worth, the problems facing the Brazilian president, Dilma Rousseff, etc. But China seems to be looking to the region as a part of its future in terms of doing business. And again, 600 million people. Do you see Jamaica figuring in that at all?
Oh, yes. China has been making steady inroads into the Jamaican economy For the past, I would say, 6, 7, 8 years now. They started out very significantly by building, rebuilding, I should say, the major highway leading from the airport, the major airport in Kingston, maybe about 5 or 10 miles long, but it was significant. And they have completed several phases of what they call Highway 2000, the north and the south leg of that highway. And now there's another highway to be built on the east coast, and they have the contract to do that. China has taken over some of the failing sugar estates, and they are involved in infrastructural development as they are in Africa and Asia. And so, yes, they are here, and they're looking to, you know, control whatever minerals that might exist and getting construction work, contracts, and so on. So, yes, China is very significant. And now China has now become one of the major investors in the island. And Jamaica is all, and they are also one of the biggest creditors as well. So, you know, that's one of the consequences of them entering the economy. So they are a big creditor. So they are now become a player, a potential political player in the politics of the country. And there are rumors that, you know, politicians are being bribed in order to get the toehold, as they were in Africa and as they were in Asia. And some of that smells, you know. And I should say, while I'm not saying that there's a direct connection between China and what I'm going to say, but leading up to the elections, there were questions about a house built by the leader of the opposition, Mr. Andrew Holness. He built a mansion, a castle, up in a place called Beverly Hills. Mm. And everybody was asking him, how did you finance this? Where did you get the money to build this house? Mm. And he has given answers that don't add up. You know, at first he didn't want to give any answers, and then he's finally given answers. But there are more questions as a result of the answers that he has given. And there's a big question sign over how he was able to afford that house, how he was able to finance it, and he has not answered all the questions. And so, without making any direct connection between China and his house, there is that, you know, factor that is looming large. Are the politicians... did China pay off the politicians? Did they pay off the Jamaica Labour Party and subsequently the People's National Party in order to be a big player in the economy here? And that's a very serious question, because we have seen it happen over and over in Africa, where it has been proven that they did pay politicians and they did pay money in order to get the minerals and to ship the minerals out and to do construction work. Sometimes the construction work was shoddy and there were problems as a result of that. So China is a big, big player in the Jamaican economy. So I would say that, you know, come April, we will be able to predict much more clearly where things are going to go politically in this country. But I would say overall, until the people begin to really stand up and begin to demand some, you know, fundamental changes and some social intervention on behalf of the people, it's going to be a very difficult situation in Jamaica for poor people and working class people.
Lloyd D'Aguilar, journalist, activist, and radio host from Jamaica, thank you very much. A pleasure as always.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.